Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Wunsch, an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild, who considers the shocking terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., and their likely impact on civil liberties for U.S. citizens and immigrants. Retired Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information, who looks at the forces that may have been responsible for the coordinated attacks and how the Bush administration and the U.S. military may react. And Robert Jensen, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, who evaluates the credibility and bias found in mainstream corporate media reporting of the New York and Washington assaults. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Progressive magazine reports that declassified U.S. military documents show that the U.S. government set out to deliberately destroy Iraq's water supply system 10 years ago, knowing full well that it would lead to an outbreak of disease. The documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency shows the cold logic that U.S. officials knew in advance that international sanctions would force Iraq's water quality to decay and harm public health. A January 22, 1991 intelligence paper predicted a shortage of pure drinking water for much of the population. According to another intelligence report, an outbreak of cholera and measles did occur in Iraqi refugee camps in 1991. The disease spread due to inadequate water treatment and poor sanitation. Young children are particularly vulnerable to infectious diseases such as diarrhea and dysentery. In protest of these conditions, last summer Congressman Tony Hall complained to the U.S. State Department about the declining quality of children's health in Iraq. He was alarmed by the rising rates of diarrhea in Iraqi children, while the U.S. government continued to block contracts through the U.N. Oil for Food program that would permit Iraq to buy new water tanks and water purification chemicals. UNESCO estimates that 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five have died due to waterborne contaminants and other shortages since the U.S.-backed sanctions have been imposed. While Mexican President Vicente Fox is pleading for immigration reform in the United States, he is simultaneously expelling thousands of poor migrants from along Mexico's southern border. In late June, Fox launched Plan Sur, or the Southern Plan, where Mexican police, with the aid of the army, swept through villages along the border with Guatemala and detained and expelled 9,000 immigrants in a 2-week period. The U.S. military provided funding and logistics for the sweep. This is only part of a major effort by Mexican authorities to stop immigration across its borders. Last year, over 150,000 immigrants were deported for attempting to enter Mexico. Yet immigrant rights activists worry about the prospect of massive human rights abuses. Mauro Versaletti of the Immigration Support Center in Guatemala City says the threat to immigrants from abuse is growing with the participation of the Mexican army in the raids. Due to the raids, Versaletti says immigrants now seek out the most dangerous roads, placing their lives in jeopardy. The Northeast Dairy Compact is often criticized as a wasteful subsidy to dairy farmers and harmful to millions of consumers. But a new study shows that recent milk industry consolidation, and not the Dairy Compact, which gives dairy farmers an extra 10 cents per gallon of milk, is responsible for recent price hikes. Professor Ron Cotterill places the blame for these price hikes on the giant milk processor Suiza Foods Corporation, which has purchased several New England dairies in recent years, and major supermarket chains such as Stop and Shop in the Northeast and Jewel and Dominick's food stores in the greater Chicago region. In an interview with the Maine Times, Cotterill stated, "What's moving the price is the pricing power of the dominant supermarket chains. In some places, they are taking an additional 50 to 75 cents per gallon." In New England, the Dairy Compact has only accounted for 4.5 cents of the recent 29-cent spike in the retail price of milk. And according to the University of Connecticut Food Marketing Policy Center, 11 cents of the price increase was pure profit. Although milk producers have attacked his research, Cotterill is not deterred. He is now calling for the Dairy Compact to use its regulatory power to rein in milk profiteering. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thank you.
The coordinated terrorist strike against New York City's World Trade Center and Pentagon in Washington, D.C., resulted in a catastrophic loss of life, with the number of dead and injured difficult to calculate in the days immediately following the attack. As the world learned, Tuesday morning, September 11th, two hijacked airliners struck each of the World Trade Center twin towers, causing the 110-story buildings to collapse. About an hour later, another plane crashed into the Pentagon in the nation's capital, causing one side of the building to fall. Speculation as to which organizations or nations may have been responsible for the assault reverberated in the nation's media. President Bush, who was quickly evacuated from Washington, stated that the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts. In this special report, Between the Lines presents three interviews examining the repercussions of the terrorist attacks. In our first interview, Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Wunsch, an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild, who considers the shocking terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., and their likely impact on civil liberties for U.S. citizens and immigrants.
There are a few words that can describe our feelings about what's happened. I do have concerns based on some things that have happened in the past, where politicians try to respond to tragic events. They want to look like they're doing something, and what they end up doing are things that are actually harmful to our society and our democracy and are not very effective at protecting our safety. They don't increase our safety at all. And let me give you some examples. First, you know, when we had the Oklahoma City bombing, the media immediately started saying it had to be, you know, Arabs or Palestinians or people from the Middle East. And in fact, it turned out to be a homegrown white American boy, Timothy McVeigh. That is surely going to happen again. There's already talk about Osama bin Laden being responsible. We don't know who's responsible. And to lump people together into groups, to discriminate based on what country they come from, what their religion is, are they Muslim, is wrong, and that's discrimination. And we've seen sort of a sad history of that in our country during World War II, for example, when Japanese Americans were rounded up on the West Coast and sent to detention camps where some remained for up to 3 years. A sad chapter in our history, one for which our government has apologized and paid some compensation to those who were in the camps. But those kinds of acts are wrong. They are anti-democratic, they are un-American, and yet people, and especially politicians, I think, leap to doing things like that. We will see, I suspect, efforts to crack down on our rights of association, freedom of speech, and unfortunately, many Americans will go along with that, thinking that that's going to somehow make us safer. Unfortunately, I think we live in a difficult and complicated world. Silencing people who disagree will not make us safer. And we need actually to have people be able to speak out. We need to know what people think. And maybe our discussion could be improved. Maybe our world could be improved if people would listen to each other. But I'm afraid we will see renewed calls for crackdowns of various kinds. Congress, a number of years ago, passed something called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, a terrible piece of legislation, you know, which called for secret trials. Various immigrants had no court appeals anymore from deportation. Congress can call it an action against terrorists, the effective Death Penalty Act, but that's just words. The actions that they take are actually harmful, I think, to our society and our fundamental rights. And, you know, it's times like these that are so difficult, where we really do have to see the true test of what kind of a society we're going to be. It's hard. I know people feel so awful and want revenge somehow, but in leaping to try to get revenge or to try to crack down, you know, who will we bomb in retaliation? Will we get the right people? I doubt it. We can put people to death, as we saw with the previous World Trade Center trials. People have, you know, been given the death penalty, but it doesn't make us safer. And it's much more complicated than the quick measures that politicians seize on to make us feel like they're doing something to protect us. The whole Star Wars program that President Bush claims he needs the money for to make us safer from foreign Star Wars. Well, this was internal attacks. So I'm just cautioning people to stop. Let's wait. Let's see what the evidence is. And let's not seize on easy answers and easy solutions that will not make us safer and will, in fact, take away the democratic freedoms that we cherish.
Sarah, as you pointed out, many Americans will applaud a crackdown on civil rights if they see the victims of those encroachment on their rights as somebody other than themselves. But what should people be thinking about in terms of the loss of their own rights down the road if the United States government takes a turn and starts to further erode our civil liberties here?
Well, I think that you make a good point, that when you see Congress or the president cracking down on one group that may be unpopular, it always carries over to the rest of the society, and our own individual rights will be violated down the road. The freedoms we cherish and that make us different from the societies we criticize for lacking in freedom, we can lose those freedoms ourselves. Once you begin to crack down on one group, our own rights are going to be lost ultimately. And so it's important for people. I just caution people to not act in the heat of this moment, this awful moment, to try to have better judgment than some of our politicians often have.
That was Sarah Wunsch, an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the National Lawyers Guild by calling area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. Since the first horrifying reports of the terror strikes in New York and Washington, defense and intelligence experts openly speculated that these highly coordinated attacks may have been the work of Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden, accused of an earlier bombing at the World Trade Center in 1993, was himself the target of U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan, not long after the Clinton administration blamed him for planning and financing two deadly attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. Fearing accusations of complicity in the New York and Washington assaults and U.S. retaliation, an official of Afghanistan's Taliban government condemned the terrorist attack and rejected suggestions that bin Laden could be behind them. But some U.S. officials, remembering the false assumptions as to the identity of the Oklahoma City bomber, were cautious in pointing a finger at any individual or group. Between the Lines' Denise Manzari spoke with retired Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information, who looks at the forces that may have been responsible for the terror attack and how the Bush administration and the U.S. military may react.
I believe that this has been an operation prepared for some period of time and involved individuals who worked their way into the service organizations of the United Airlines and American Airlines. Some people employed at low levels to clean the airplanes, to clean the lavatories and so on, would have access to the airplanes before they were flown, and they could introduce weapons, hide them, and then when the agents, the hijackers, came aboard, they would know where the weapons were hidden and they could take over the airplane, so that they had people at the right place at the right time to do this.
Do you think that this is linked to one particular group?
I suspect it does. It is well coordinated, certainly very, very well concealed. No indication the United States got any inkling at all of an impending operation against our interests.
President Bush said that the United States will hunt down those responsible for this. How do you look at that approach?
Well, that's a natural thing for him to say, and it's probably true that if we have intelligence that we can exploit and track the responsibility to an individual or a state, we will certainly try to avenge this dastardly attack. But I must say that if we had no advance warning, no intelligence suggesting any group was engaged in planning such a thing, how can we track the intelligence back to the offender?
Many people are reacting to visuals broadcast on television of Palestinians in the streets jumping for joy, saying that it's the United States got what it deserved. What is your opinion of that?
The relationship between the United States and the Islamic world are strained, of course, by our close relationship with Israel. And so the Palestinians, who despise and resent Israel in every respect, are probably happy, or at least pleased, that the United States is suffering. It's the old Arab saying, my enemy's friend is my enemy. I would not place too much weight on that in terms of what U.S. policy and response should be.
The media is also implicating Osama bin Laden immediately, as they have in the past regarding the Oklahoma City bombing, where it turned out to be Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. What do you think? Does he actually have the ability and wherewithal to carry out such a coordinated attack against the United States?
If you make up your mind that in the future you're going to accomplish a certain task, and you put people in position to accomplish it at a very low cost, actually, very little money involved, if you have dedicated, well-trained people, you can carry out this sort of an operation very efficiently. It isn't high-tech, so intelligence warning us where and when a threat may develop is extremely important. The other one is a little harder to explain and longer to accomplish, but that is to attack the roots of terrorism. People are in abject poverty. They're suffering all over the world. Individuals see their children die of preventable diseases or malnutrition. They become fertile ground for terrorist actions. They have nothing to lose. They can't even support or protect their own family. And so they become willing to take action against the party, the nation that they think has caused their problems. And the United States, because of its strong military position around the world and its great wealth, is a target in their minds for retribution for their own problems. They use what terrorists have, which is stealth, covert, clandestine means to take violent retaliation against their hated enemy.
Is it your feeling that we will ever fully know who was responsible for this? Do you think there will be information in the black boxes of these planes?
I have a strong feeling that politics and national interests are going to obscure the information. We never will be absolutely certain that what we're hearing is the truth and the whole truth. If nothing else will do it, this will call attention to the fatuous nature of a national missile defense system. It would take a rogue nation millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to create the capability to attack us with one or two missiles, and for virtually no investment at all, they can go after us through terrorism, and our national missile defense won't do a thing to protect one American.
That was retired Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. Contact the center by calling area code 202-332-0600 or visit their website at www.cdi.org. Not long after the first video footage of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon was broadcast, TV newsrooms were presenting their reports, adorned by designer logos and dramatic theme songs. Typical was the cable news network's graphic title logo, which shouted "America Under Attack" over an ominous soundtrack. This was the context in which initial reports covering the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing wrongfully blamed Arab terrorists. Of course, TV viewers later learned that U.S.-based right-wing extremists were responsible. With the subordination of journalism to the demands of ratings and profit margins, many broadcast news divisions have transformed their reports on breaking news stories to something more akin to a game show. The world of infotainment, as it has been dubbed in broadcast and cable TV, often focuses more attention on style than substance. Today's corporate television executives have found it far less expensive and more profitable to invite several guests into a studio to shout at each other rather than devote resources needed to hire skilled journalists to uncover the hidden truth. This has led many critics to charge the media with gross negligence of their professional ethics that, in the end, deprives the public of vital information. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Jensen, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, who evaluates the credibility and bias found in mainstream corporate media reporting of shocking events such as the New York, Washington terrorist attacks.
Well, in some sense, they're doing a very good job. I mean, it's incredible the amount of information one can get very quickly. But I think what we have to look at is not just the flow of information, but the framework in which that information is being presented. And I think in this vein, the U.S. media is fairly predictably repeating the standard frames in which we often understand these things. So, for instance, there's talk of how this terrorist act is irrational and the product of the hatred of the U.S. and how these are angry and vicious people, I heard one anchor say. And what that does is suggest that anybody who would want to strike out at the U.S. is somehow crazy. It's not to condone terrorism to say that one understands what motivates terrorist acts. And I think that what we have to understand, and after a period of grieving, which I think is very appropriate after this kind of event, I think what the American people have to do, and the media could help do this, although they're not doing it so far, is ask the question, why is it that a group would want to, you know, make an attack like this? That is, what would lead a group to be desperate enough to attack civilians? And I think there are perfectly rational reasons. It's not to say I agree with terrorist acts, but there are rational reasons that people would think about this kind of activity, and I think that's one of the things we have to think about. The other, I think, is that when we talk about terrorism, it's almost implicitly defined within the media talk as those acts against us and people we like. Is it terrorism if the United States commits similar acts? I saw Sandy Berger on TV, the former National Security Advisor for the Clinton Administration, who was National Security Advisor when the Clinton Administration illegally bombed a pharmaceutical plant in the Sudan as a counter-terrorist move. Well, if we're going to talk seriously about terrorism, we have to come to terms with the fact that the biggest purveyor of terrorism in the world these days is the United States, that the attacks on civilians we have committed are every bit as egregious as this attack. And I think these are very hard things for a nation to deal with. I think the media's job should be helping us deal with them, and that's, I think, the main problem with the coverage so far.
Robert Jensen, what about the show business aspects of coverage like this? We have the theme music and the glossy, glitzy logos that come up on the screen even half an hour after this tragedy was first reported. Yeah. How does that affect the substance of what's covered? How does that change what the American people hear and learn in these reports?
Well, we all remember that CNN sort of made its mark as a network during the Gulf War. And they did that by not only providing information, but by sort of playing up the very aspects you've just mentioned. And I think there's a lot of human emotion in the events today. I think we've all felt it. The question is, how do you convey that, and how are you honest about that without turning it into some sort of melodrama? How do you avoid turning news into basically some sort of television program in the worst sense of the word? And I think the media tend to go the other way, because that is what draws viewers. That is the way you hold viewers. And I think it violates a sort of basic journalistic principle about trying to provide information in a way that helps people understand the world, that instead of manipulating people's emotions, you know, just the use of a term like America under attack is so loaded. Who is under attack in America, and what's that attack about? But this sort of almost sort of B-movie kind of construction of it, I think, is very dangerous, because it helps frame people's understanding of the issue. And in this case, I think it frames it in a way that really keeps us from coming to terms with what's really at issue.
The same day as the attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., the television media showed images of Palestinians celebrating in the streets in the occupied territories. What kind of leverage does the media have to interpret these images for the American people? And I say that because certainly American citizens, in view of this tragedy here that goes very deep, will interpret those images as, you know, this is us against them, and certainly can breed a lot of hatred of other peoples.
I think we shouldn't ignore the fact that those demonstrations went on in Palestine. But I think the problem is, as you said, how do you understand that? How do you contextualize that? If you're a Palestinian and you understand that the oppression of your people has been carried out with the support of the United States, and in fact, it's likely that that oppression would have ended a long time ago if not for U.S. support of the policies that Israel has pursued, is it surprising that you might react with that kind of glee? Now, I think it's unfortunate. I think it's inhumane in a certain way. But it's certainly something one can understand. And simply repeating that image over and over again with no attempt to ask why might a Palestinian feel this, and to make it seem as if that image represents all of the feeling of the Palestinian people. I know Palestinians. I know they are not rejoicing right now. I know that the emotion they have felt for their own people and the sadness is no doubt being transferred to the civilians who died. You know, I think it's incredibly simplistic to repeat images like that without looking at the broader context and without understanding that that image is not, in fact, the story itself. There is a more complex story in Palestine. What I have seen so far is a string of these terrorism experts, former military officials, former national security officials. These are people who helped construct the policies, U.S. foreign policies, that I think lead to this kind of terrorist activity. So I think people listening and watching CBS, ABC, CNN, whatever, have to keep that in mind, that they are not getting unfiltered access to information. They are getting an account of the world that is framed in a certain way with certain political and cultural understandings underneath it, and that's what we have to always be aware of.
That was Robert Jensen, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin. Contact the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, to read more about media omission and bias by calling area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.